Settlement to Superpower by Abraham Ash. Episode 5, Divide and Conquer. Hello everybody and welcome back. I apologize for the length of time that has elapsed between this episode and the last, but following the issues with my computer, which I've mentioned to you last episode, a string of delays and misfortunes have prevented me from getting this episode up. Although the above misfortunes seem to have not yet ended, I'm nonetheless fairly confident that they will no longer delay my output of content. So, I won't tell you that the next episodes will come soon, because every time I say something like that, something or another comes up and delays me. But I do hope that there will be no more delays. Anyways, we begin today's episode precisely where we left off last episode, with the entry of the Aztec ambassador into Cortez's camp at San Juan de Ulua. This ambassador was a steward of Montezuma's by the name of Teudal. Teudal declared that he had been sent by the Emperor Montezuma, who had heard of these strangers' arrival. Cortez dissembled and responded that he was an ambassador of his king, Don Carlos, who ruled over the greater part of the world. Don Carlos had heard of Montezuma and his mighty empire, and had dispatched him to meet Montezuma face to face. Cortes and Teudal exchanged gifts, with Teudal giving Cortes some jewels and feather ornaments, and Cortes giving Teudal some European clothing and a chair. Cortes then paraded his men in military formation and had them fire their cannons, the sound of which frightened Teudal so much that he fell to the ground in fright. Cortes then had a famous exchange with Teudal, in which the hapless steward unwittingly sealed the Aztec Empire's doom. Cortes asked Teudal whether the Aztecs had lots of gold, as his men had a disease which could only be healed by gold. Teudal responded in the affirmative, and in so answering, informed Cortes that at last he had struck the motherlode. Teudal expressed interest in the conquistadors' helmets, which he said resembled the headwear of their gods, and so Cortes lent him a rusty old helmet, on condition that it was to be returned filled with gold dust. Teudal then took his leave of the Spanish, instructing several of the delegates to remain and see to these strangers' comfort. What the Spanish didn't know at the time, but would very shortly find out, was that their arrival in Mexico had struck a raw nerve in the Aztec Empire. Bad omens had been appearing for some time in Tenochtitlan, including fearsome visions and a fire in the temple of one of their gods. The old legend stated how long, long ago, Quetzalcoatl, the bearded god, had been banished from Mexico across the sea, and how he had promised to return one day to rule over the Aztecs. The arrival of these white-bearded men who reportedly never slept, whose clothing and weapons flashed like the sun, who rode strange and fearsome beasts never before seen in their lands, and who were capable of producing thunderbolts and lightning at will, must surely be Quetzalcoatl and his cohort of gods. Moreover, the Aztecs were truly frightened by the fact that the Spanish had arrived in the first year of the Aztecs' 52-year calendar cycle, the year in which, should the Aztecs fail to propitiate the gods, the world would come to an end. Teudal soon returned to Cortes and brought with him many gifts of gold and jewels, along with Montezuma's response. Montezuma was honored to receive these gods from across the sea, but alas, he was unable to meet them as he had religious duties to attend to in Tenochtitlan, which was too far and too arduous a journey for his honored guest to take. However, Teudal continued, Montezuma would give the Spanish anything at all which they required to heal their strange disease. All they had to do was ask, and the goods would be delivered. But the strangers must remain near the coast and not journey too far inland. Cortes replied that a meeting with Montezuma was non-negotiable. His ruler had demanded it and would be extremely cross with him should he fail to meet the emperor. Teudal departed and returned one more time and told Cortes firmly that Montezuma would not see him. That was an impossibility. Cortes would simply return home. Cortes replied with equal firmness that he would not leave Mexico until he had laid eyes on Montezuma. At this, Teodal got angry, and he left Cortes in a fury, taking with him all those Aztec delegates who had till now been feeding Cortes. From here on in, Montezuma would try and make Cortes's ascent to Tenochtitlan as arduous and uncomfortable as possible. Nonetheless, Montezuma was in a panic regarding these strangers, and that panic communicated itself to all those in Tenochtitlan. Until the Spanish defeat on La Noche Triste, the Aztecs' morale and fighting spirit would be fatally low. But despite the advantageous position in which Cortes now found himself, it was by no means clear that he would in fact have the opportunity to capitalize on the situation. You see, by now, the men of Cortes's expedition had reached a crucial crossroads. Governor Velasquez's partisans insisted that they return home to Cuba, as they had fulfilled their mission. They had rescued Aguilar, the interpreter, from the Mayans, they had gathered lots of gold, and their knowledge of Mexico and her empire was greatly enriched. On the other hand, another faction, led by Pedro de Alvarado, Grijalva's old captain whom Cortes had recruited, had no desire to leave Mexico now and see the fruits of their venture reaped exclusively by Velasquez and those in his favor. They wished instead to break free of Velasquez's control and take the riches of Mexico for themselves. They wanted to establish a settlement here and stake a claim on Mexico and her riches, before hordes of Spanish settlers showed up and displaced them. Cortes played his hand cleverly and pretended to be persuaded by the Velasquez faction, only for those who supported founding a settlement to furiously upbraid him for deceiving them before they left Cuba by talking of a potential settlement. Cortes feigned agonized indecision, and he sent out two expeditions, commanded by Francisco de Montejo and Juan Velasquez de Leon, the two leaders of the Velasquez faction. And yes, by the way, Velasquez de Leon was a cousin of the governor Velasquez. Anyways, he sent out these expeditions to see if they could find a potentially advantageous site for a new settlement. Of course, Montejo and Velasquez were eager to lead these expeditions, and in so doing to strengthen their faction by later maintaining that they had found no suitable site for settlement. For his part, Cortes didn't really care whether Montejo or Velasquez de Leon would muddle their reports, as long as they were safely out of the way when he played his full hand. As soon as Montejo and Velasquez de Leon were gone, Cortes sprang into action, launching an effective legal coup d'etat. He first gathered together a commission of his allies who, after no doubt much agonized decision, decided that Cortes had satisfactorily completed the mission he had been assigned by Velasquez. Upon hearing that, Cortes declared his mission complete and promptly resigned his commission as captain of Velasquez's expedition. Then he had his allies pressure him into creating a municipality to occupy the area and to trade with the local natives, which Cortes did, declaring the municipality to be a new colony and as such to be governed by local elections and not by Governor Velasquez until His Majesty Charles V decided otherwise. In this manner, Cortes managed to semi-legally shed his allegiance to Velasquez back in Cuba and make himself directly answerable to the crown alone. He and his men were now no longer an expedition. They were now, on paper at least, a city. Of course, it was a curious sort of city without any houses or even a decided upon location. But as far as Cortes was concerned, that would suffice. When Montejo and Velasquez de Leon returned, they found a fait accompli. Ironically, this bit of legal sleight of hand was inspired by Governor Velasquez's own example, as during his conquest of Cuba, he had established several cities, and the independence of Cuba from Hispaniola, in a similar fashion. Of course, in Cuba, Velasquez was doing what he did with the permission of the authorities back in Hispaniola, whereas over here Cortez was clearly going against the will of Velasquez. Cortez must have known the seriousness of the risk he was taking. In the eyes of Velasquez and his partisans, Cortez's actions were an illegal rebellion, and Cortez must have known the fate of the last conquistador who had attempted to buck the control of his governor. Vasco Núñez de Balboa, conquistador of Panama and discoverer of the Pacific Ocean, had similarly run afoul of his governor just a year earlier, and for pretty much the same reason, attempting to assert his own independence. The sorry tale had ended a month before Cortez's departure with Balboa's decapitation at the hands of the governor on unsubstantiated charges of treason. Cortez surely knew that Velasquez would not be impressed by his legal arguments, nor would he hesitate to inflict the same punishment as poor Balboa had received on him. The only way Cortez could justify what he was doing was if he would achieve a smashing success, significant enough to bring him into royal favor and, by extension, royal protection. Cortez, the newly appointed governor of Veracruz, which was the name they decided to call their new city, decided that the ideal place to build their not-yet-existent town was near Quiahuiztlan, some 40 miles north of their current encampment at San Juan de Ulua. The supplies and most of the cannons were transported by sea to the designated site, while Cortez led some 400 warriors northwards by the overland route. As the Spaniards traveled, the Totonacs of the city of Sempoala provided them with food and drink. As they entered the city of Sempoala, the Totonacs received them with great enthusiasm, plying them with food, drink, and beds, and examining their horses and beards with great curiosity. Cortez and his men spent a comfortable 2 weeks in Sempoala, during which time Cortez gleaned whatever information he could from the local chief. The Totonacs, said the chief, had been free and prosperous until relatively recently, when the Aztecs came and subjugated them with great brutality and destruction. The chief bitterly complained about the excessive tribute the Aztecs had imposed upon them, constantly demanding their goods and even their children for sacrifice. The chief of Sempoala also told Cortes about the rivalry between the Tlaxcalans and the Aztecs, and he urged Cortes to create a coalition against the Aztecs comprised of the Totonacs, the Tlaxcalans, and the sundry other disaffected cities living under Aztec domination. It was probably at this moment that Cortes's plan of action finally crystallized in his mind. He would launch a multi-pronged assault on Aztec hegemony, both by cultivating an alliance with the Aztec Empire's enemies with a mind towards overthrowing them, as well as simultaneously cowing Montezuma and the Aztec nobility into petrified inaction. Cortes no doubt remembered learning in his university days, far across the sea in distant Salamanca, the time-honored maxim of Caesar's, divide et impera, divide and rule. From Sempoala, Cortes moved on to Quiahuiztlan, where his newly incorporated town was to be founded. Near the site he found a small Totonac village, and he and his men entered the village as their ships with the supplies still hadn't arrived. There too the chief complained to the Spanish about the heavy Aztec yoke, and as if to punctuate his point, an Aztec delegation chose this very moment to make their sweeping and arrogant entry into the village. These delegates upbraided the chiefs of Quiahuiztlan for accepting and feeding these white strangers without the permission of Montezuma, who had determined that they should not be assisted in any manner whatsoever. As a punishment, the delegates declared, the Totonacs of Quiahuiztlan would need to provide another 20 captives to be sacrificed in Tenochtitlan. The Totonacs were distraught and terrified, but Cortes persuaded them to do as he said. They were to tell the Aztec delegation that not only were the Totonacs no longer going to pay tribute, but as a matter of fact, they were taking the Aztec delegates prisoner. As frightened as they must have been at the enormity of the step they were taking, It must have been with increasing gusto that the Totonacs upbraided the Aztec delegation, bound them to poles by their necks, wrists, and ankles, and hoisted the helpless delegates, sputtering in incoherent rage, away to a dark and dingy cell. This was, however, only the opening act of Cortes's game. He had no desire to goad Montezuma into open war by needlessly and openly attacking his emissaries, and so he now resorted to some underhanded diplomacy. That night, he instructed his men to secretly bring him the two brightest delegates of the entire bunch. Cortes pretended to be unaware of just who these men were, and he proceeded to inquire into their identities. The men indignantly responded that they were representatives of the Emperor Montezuma, and they were shocked to be treated in such an appalling fashion, and could only assume that their ill treatment had been at the instigation of these strangers. The Totonacs were a barbarous people, they sneered, and they had no doubt that the Totonacs would rebel against the Aztecs at the first chance they got. Cortes mollified the angry delegates and informed them that he had absolutely nothing to do with their arrest, and that he was shocked to find that the Totonacs had so mistreated the servants of the great Montezuma. For Montezuma was a friend of his sovereign, averred Cortes, and his king had instructed him to meet the great Montezuma face to face. Cortes reiterated that he came to Montezuma as a friend, and he sincerely hoped that Montezuma would not spurn his extended hand of friendship. After having reassured the delegates that he would personally ensure that their friends would not be killed by the benighted Totonacs, Cortes had his men boat the delegates to safety. The next morning, when the chief of Kiahuitzlan found that two of the prisoners had escaped, he was enraged and ready to kill the others until Cortes persuaded him not to. Instead, Cortes took custody of the delegates himself and informed the chief that he and all the rest of the Totonacs were no longer subjects of Tenochtitlan. And if it didn't bother the chief too much, Cortes would like to release the remaining Aztec delegates. The grateful chief acquiesced to whatever his liberator decided, and Cortes released the Aztecs. Cortes had once again played his cards brilliantly. He had driven a wedge between the Totonacs and their Aztec overlords, and had still managed to not provoke the puzzled Aztecs into open warfare. This was Cortes's way of doing things, not brute force, but rather guile, cunning, and subtle persuasiveness. The news spread rapidly throughout the Totonac cities that the gods who had come from the east had liberated them from the shackles of Aztec dominion. Very soon the resolve and mettle of the Spanish liberators would be put to the test. A delegation from Sempoala came to the Spanish and told them that the Aztecs were occupying a hill fort in Totonac territory. When the Totonacs declared their independence from the Aztecs fled from the fort. But now they had returned, and it was feared that from the fort, the Aztecs were preparing to strike at and crush the Totonac rebellion. The Sempoalans requested from Cortes that he dislodge the Aztecs, and Cortes had little option but to oblige. Not that he minded necessarily, of course, only that he had little choice in the matter. As it turned out, the Spanish had a jolly easy time of the whole business. The Aztec army came out to meet them, fully painted and decked out for battle. But when they beheld the Spanish with their horses and beards and gleaming armor, they simply turned tail and fled, and the few who remained were easily disarmed and taken prisoner by the Spanish. The Spanish handed the few prisoners over to the Totonacs, with the express stipulation that none of them be killed. With this minor action, Cortes strengthened his position and stature among the Totonacs immeasurably. Following their little diplomatic victory, Cortes and his men founded the city which had until now only existed as an abstract legal entity, formally naming it Villarica de la Veracruz, which we will refer to henceforth as simply Veracruz. The timing of Veracruz's founding was most serendipitous, as it was on that same day, 28th of June 1519, that King Carlos I of Spain was crowned in Frankfurt am Main as Emperor Charles V. Cortes decided to send Montejo, who had since been bought over from the Velasquez's faction to Cortes's by way of a hefty bribe, to Spain in order to present the king with a favorable rendering of Cortes's actions. Cortes sent with Montejo a letter addressed to the king describing, somewhat hyperbolically, the fabulous wealth he had discovered in mighty Mexico, and in which Cortes stated his intention to subjugate the empire for the crown. Cortes also sent along with Montejo a large quantity of gold and treasures to give to the king, to further reinforce the case he had made in his letter. Montejo would do his job admirably over the next couple of years, and would succeed in positively spinning Cortes's action to the royal court back in Spain. However, despite Cortes's successful coup and his effective decapitation of the opposing faction, a significant contingent remained dissatisfied with Cortes's conduct. As far as they were concerned, Cortes was nothing but a roguish mutineer, an outlaw who had betrayed the trust of his superiors. A group of his men, which included Velasquez de Leon, disgruntled at his conduct and the abandonment of their cause by Montejo, began to plot a mutiny. Their plan was to seize one of Cortes's ships, kill its captain, and sail back to Cuba in time to alert Velasquez to what Cortes was up to, allowing him to then be able to intercept the perfidious Montejo along with his goods and letters before he could reach Spain and the king. Cortes, however, caught wind of this mutinous conspiracy, and this time, with his position greatly strengthened, he didn't beat around the bush with diplomatic finesse. This time he showed the steel behind the velvet glove, and at the instigation of the crusty Alvarado, responded with overwhelming and brutal force. Cortes arrested all of the conspirators and dealt harshly with the ringleaders. The two men whom Cortes had determined were the chief instigators of the plot were hanged. One sailor had part of his foot chopped off, and three brothers who had agreed to sail the stolen brig back to Seville were given 100 lashes each. Velasquez de Leon himself was spared, probably because Cortes A. was unwilling to kill a cousin of Velasquez's, and B. because to win him over with undeserved clemency, as Cortes did, was far more advantageous to Cortes than simply executing him, as it in fact turned out to be. This aborted mutiny also led to one of the most enduring images of the conquest of Mexico, Cortes's scuttling of his fleet. Realizing that his men could at any minute mutiny again and sail for home, Cortes decided that he must remove any possibility of that ever occurring. To accomplish that, Cortes declared that all but three of the 12 ships they had brought with them were no longer seaworthy, and he ordered them scuttled. This was Cortes's Rubicon. The die was now cast, and the choice which confronted him and his men was stark in its simplicity. It was victory or death. With this decisive action, Cortes stamped out any significant opposition within his own expedition, and he would no longer have to worry about potential mutinies among his men. At least not until death and disease would begin to take their toll. But that doesn't mean that Cortes faced no more challenges to his control over the Spanish expedition. The next challenge came in the form of a ship arriving from Jamaica, at the behest of Governor Garay of that island. Garay, a veteran explorer, or I should say a veteran patron of the explorers, had heard about the voyages of Grijalva, and later of Cortes's expedition to Yucatan and Mexico under the auspices of Governor Velasquez, and he wanted in on the profits. He dispatched a fleet of 4 ships to Mexico, where Cortes's men made contact with them by sending one of their men galloping along the shoreline in a red cape. Several of the Jamaicans formed a landing party and landed, and boldly asserted that their governor held rightful claim to these lands. Cortes at first simply invited them to bring their captain ashore to visit Veracruz, but when they demurred, Cortes simply had them arrested. Subsequently, Cortes managed to persuade most of them to join his expedition. A second landing group was sent ashore, but this group had no more luck than their predecessors, and they too were persuaded to surrender and join Cortes' force. Following this, the commander of Governor Garay's expedition, who had in fact been an acquaintance of Cortes back in Cuba, gave up and sailed back to Jamaica. From here on in until his arrival at Tenochtitlan, Cortes would no longer have to guard his back. Until, that is, the arrival of Velasquez's army from Cuba, but we'll get to that later. For now, Cortes was able to forge forward against the Aztecs, unimpeded by his own compatriots. So now just to take stock of Cortes' position. He had encountered the wealthy Mexican Empire, had succeeded in firing an opening shot across their bow while still maintaining a believable pretense of amicability, had won the Totonacs over to his side, and had succeeded in establishing a base from which he could trade with friendly natives and wage war with hostiles. And he accomplished all this in the face of significant opposition within his own expedition by the partisans of Governor Velasquez, as well as by the force of Governor Garay, whom he silenced with a clever combination of charisma, deceit, force, and manipulation. In August 1519, Cortes and his expedition set out for the interior, to the great city of Tenochtitlan and the Emperor Montezuma. The Aztecs, of course, protested, but Cortes paid them no heed. Now, by this point, it began to dawn on Montezuma that these foreigners, or gods perhaps, were not going to be dissuaded from their stated intention of reaching Tenochtitlan, and their presumed intention of conquering it by mere words alone. Montezuma thus decided on a four-part strategy to counter this threat. The first part of his strategy was to make the road to Tenochtitlan as difficult as possible. Nobody was to give the Spanish any food, drink, shelter, or aid. Montezuma understood that this course of action was unlikely to turn back the Spanish, but it couldn't hurt to try. The second part of his strategy was to make sure that these Spaniards would not, under any circumstance whatsoever, join up with the Aztecs' hated rivals, the Tlaxcalans. To this end, Montezuma's delegates urged the Spanish not to take the shorter, more direct southern route to Tenochtitlan through Tlaxcalan territory, but rather to take the more circuitous northern route through Aztec territory, where, the Spaniards were assured, they would be far safer. And this pretty neatly brings us to the third element of Montezuma's strategy. The Spaniards were to be led through difficult Aztec terrain not only to prevent them from linking up with the Tlaxcalans, but also so that the Aztec delegates would be able to potentially lead them into an ambush, where the superior numbers of the Aztecs would be able to be brought to bear. And finally, should all of these attempts fail, Montezuma hoped to give the Spaniards whatever they wished, in the hopes of retrieving whatever was possible from a disastrous situation. As we shall see, the Aztecs attempted, and failed, to implement each of these four courses of action at various points in time. In any event, Cortes disregarded the Aztecs' entreaties that he remain in their territory and take the northern route, and opted instead to travel to Tenochtitlan by way of Tlaxcala. On the 31st of August 1519, the Spanish expedition, with Montezuma's delegates and the Totonac allies of the Spanish in tow, crossed over the frontier into Tlaxcalan territory. But if Cortes was expecting the sort of gracious welcome he had received from the Totonacs, or even the lukewarm, polite greetings he had received from Montezuma's delegates, well, in that case, he was in for a rude awakening. You see, the Tlaxcalans had not maintained their independence from the Aztec Empire for over a century by being all cuddly and singing kumbaya around the campfire together. The Tlaxcalans were a warrior people who would combat any foreign incursion with vigor and tenacity. When the Tlaxcalans saw the strange force cross their border from Aztec-controlled lands, with Aztec delegates in tow at that, they concluded that these men or gods must surely be allies of the hated Aztecs, and as such, must be exterminated immediately. This judgment was made despite the fact that Cortes sent two delegates ahead of him, announcing that he came in peace and friendship. Tlaxcala had been invaded through Aztec trickery in the past, and the Tlaxcalans were not about to be duped again. The Tlaxcalans took the two delegates Cortes had sent prisoner, and indeed they would have sacrificed and eaten them had they not managed to flee in the confusion of the Tlaxcalan war preparations. The terror-stricken delegates returned to Cortes, informing him that all of Tlaxcala was up in arms against them and would fiercely resist any further Spanish incursion into their land. Cortes had obviously hoped for a more peaceful welcome, but be it as it were, he and his men were prepared to fight. And fight they would, over a fierce 3 days of battle, during which time the Spanish thought they were surely lost. The battle began, as most great battles do, with a minor skirmish, waged between the Spanish horsemen and a band of 30 Tlaxcalan forward scouts. Basically, Cortes sent his cavalry forward to capture a few of the scouts, in order to send them back to the Tlaxcalan lines with gifts and promises of peace. However, these scouts put up a brave and vigorous fight, injuring a great many Spaniards and their horses, compelling the Spanish forces to stop trying to capture the Tlaxcalans alive, but rather to kill them in battle. As this little skirmish developed, a Tlaxcalan force of about 3,000 fell upon the Spanish horsemen and began raining arrows and stones upon them. Seeing this, the main Spanish force advanced and joined in the fight as well, and the battle raged for the rest of the day, with the Spanish slowly forcing the Tlaxcalans back. But the Tlaxcalans succeeded in retaining good order. By sundown, the battle petered out, with 4 Spaniards seriously wounded, one of whom would die in the coming days from his wounds, and 17 Tlaxcalans killed, as well as many wounded. The next day's battle opened with the appearance of a Tlaxcalan army numbering 6,000 men, advancing upon the Spanish position. Cortes sent out to them 3 Tlaxcalans who had been captured the day before, once again professing his desire for peace, but the Tlaxcalans were in no mood for peace. They attacked the Spanish with ferocious energy and the Spanish fought back. Gradually, as had occurred the previous day, the Spanish forced the Tlaxcalans into a disciplined retreat, and the Spanish pressed their advantage. However, what the Spanish didn't realize then was that this entire attack and retreat was all a ruse, and before they knew it, they had followed the retreating troops into a ravine where 40,000 Tlaxcalan warriors lay in ambush. Now the Spanish were in serious trouble. They were surrounded on all sides by a furious foe who numbered something around 80 times their size. They could not counterattack because any man who would step out of formation would be encircled and overwhelmed by the Tlaxcalans. Compounding their already serious situation, their horses were all but useless on the broken terrain of the ravine in which they found themselves. Even worse, the Tlaxcalans were concentrating all their best warriors around the horses, pulling them out of the Spanish ranks and then hacking at them from all sides. They succeeded in decapitating a horse and mortally wounding its rider in this manner, and they hauled off the dead horse to the temple of their gods. Now they knew that these horses were mortal creatures, just as prone to death as any other animal. In any event, eventually the Spanish managed to force their way out of the ravine and get onto level ground, and at this point they began to inflict heavy casualties on the Tlaxcalans with their muskets and crossbows. Nonetheless, the fight raged on desperately until nightfall, when the Tlaxcalans retired. The Spanish had survived, but only just. They were almost all wounded, some in multiple locations, and fever and disease were beginning to take their toll. The Spanish withdrew to some fortified terrain to rest up and succor their wounds. On the next day, the two armies did not clash with one another, and instead the Spanish forces ravaged the countryside, burning and pillaging, hoping to bring the Tlaxcalans to terms in that manner. We should note, however, that even this relatively brutal harrying of Tlaxcala bore no similarity to the Spanish depredations on Cuba and Hispaniola. This was no mindless, sadistic orgy of torture and slaughter. Rather, it was very clearly a tactical measure designed to compel the Tlascalans to accept the Spanish offer of friendship, or more accurately, vassalage. To reinforce this point, Cortes released the prisoners his men had taken in the course of the battle and the raids, and sent them to the commander of the Tlascalan forces, Xicotencatl the Younger, with a message of peace. The response Cortes received was chilling. Xicotencatl said that the Spanish could indeed make peace, if they would go to his father, Xicotencatl the Elder, and there surrender themselves up for sacrifice and consumption, and to so make peace with the Tlascalans and their gods. This was the only sort of peace he was offering, and he said he would deliver them this peace tomorrow morning. The next morning, Xicotencatl arrived with his army of some 50,000 warriors, fresh and ready for battle. The Spanish were exhausted, and Bernal Diaz, the chronicler of the Spanish expedition, relates how most of them assumed that they would not survive the day. His account of the battle, which I will read here, gives us some impression of the clamor, the terror, the ferocity of the battle, and of the grim determination of the Spaniards therein. The next morning, the 5th of December, 1519, we mustered the horses. There was not one of the wounded men who did not come forward to join the ranks and give as much help as he could. The crossbowmen were warned to use the store of darts very cautiously, some of them loading while the others were shooting, and the musketeers were to act in the same way, while the men with sword and shield were instructed to aim their cuts and thrusts at the bowels, so that they would not dare to come as close as they had previously. The artillery was all ready for action, and the horsemen had already been instructed to aid one another and to hold their lances short, and to not stop and spear anyone unless in the face or the eyes, charging and returning at a hand gallop, and no soldier was on any account to break away from the ranks. With our banner unfurled and with four of our comrades guarding the standard bearer, Corral, we set out from our camp. We had not marched half a quarter of a league before we began to see the fields crowded with warriors with great feather crests and distinguishing devices, and to hear the blare of horns and trumpets. Here would be a great opportunity to write down in proper order what happened to us in this most perilous and doubtful battle, for so many warriors surrounded us on all sides that it might be compared to a great plain, 2 leagues long and about the same breadth, and in its midst 400 men. Thus, all the plain was swarming with warriors, and we stood 400 men in number, and of those, many sick or wounded. And we know for certain that this time, our foe came with the determination to leave none of us alive, excepting those who would be sacrificed to their idols. To go back to our battle. How they began to charge on us. What a hail of stones sped from their slings. As for their bowmen, the javelins lay like corn on the threshing floor, all of them barbed and fire-hardened, which would pierce any armor and would reach the vitals where there is no protection. The men with swords and shields and other arms larger than swords, such as broadswords and lances, how they pressed on us and with what valor and what mighty shouts and yells they charged upon us. The steady bearing of our artillery, musketeers, and crossbowmen was indeed a help to us, and we did the enemy much damage. And those of them who came close to us with their swords and broadswords met with such swordplay from us that they were forced back, and they did not close in on us so often as in the last battle. The horsemen were so skillful and bore themselves so valiantly that after God who protected us, they were our bulwark. However, I saw that our troops were in considerable confusion, so that neither the shouts of Cortes nor the other captains availed to make them close up their ranks, and so many Indians charged down on us that it was only by a miracle of swordplay that we could make them give way so that our ranks could be reformed. One thing only saved our lives, and that was that the enemy were so numerous and so crowded on one another that the shots wrought havoc among them. End quote. The battle raged on in such a manner throughout the day until the Spaniards succeeded in killing a high-ranking Tlascalan warrior, upon which the Tlascalans began to lose heart and withdraw from the field in good order. The Spanish had survived yet another furious onslaught, but it was becoming increasingly clear to them that they could not hold on for that much longer. They had already lost 45 men to battle, injury, and disease, and their entire remaining force was either seriously wounded or ill. Again, they asked the Tlascalans for peace, but this time they boldly declared that this was the final time they were making an offer to Tlascala of peace and friendship. If they would spurn the Spanish offer just one more time, the Spanish declared that they would utterly destroy the Tlascalan people and cities, down to the last brick and man. This time, Cortes's confidence and bluff paid off. Xicotencatl the Elder, father of the brash Xicotencatl the Younger, overrode his son's insistence that they were able to beat the Spanish, and declared that the Tlascalans would make their peace with the Spanish. Indeed, they would join into alliance with them, and would provide appropriate hostages to ensure that they would keep faith with their pact. Cortes accepted their offer, much to the consternation of the Aztec delegates in their camp, who warned him that the Tlascalans were a treacherous people, and were likely to break their end of the treaty. Future events would show that this Aztec accusation was entirely false, as the Tlascalans would remain faithful allies of the Spanish throughout thick and thin, even as defeat stared them in the face. Montezuma must have groaned in despair when he learned that these strange men had, in the space of a week, done what the Aztecs were unable to do over the course of an entire century. But still, he attempted to salvage what he could of the situation. He sent gifts and a message to Cortes urging him to not go to Tlascala, as the people there were thieves and backstabbers and would not hesitate to betray and slaughter him and his men. Nevertheless, Cortes persisted, and he soon accepted the invitation of the Tlascalan chiefs to come to the city of Tlascala. Cortes and his men were received with much joy and pomp in Tlascala, and the ensuing 2 weeks of Tlascalan hospitality solidified the bond and the trust which the Spanish and Tlascalans held towards one another. But Cortes would not stay for long. It was now time, he decided, to finally march upon the great city, Tenochtitlan.